other. For others, it may be the desire to be accepted within the system so that they can live with the same luxuries and with the same, live the same way a Westerner, an American, a Canadian, that is not Muslim, would be living their lives. Wanting to enjoy that type of lifestyle, but at the same time, wanting to remain Muslim. Like, as I said, this category of people, I'm trying to refer to those who don't have an issue with accepting Islam as a religion, and they feel attached to it, and they don't want to leave it. There's very few that have actually left Islam. But seeing the truth to the ideology, to the belief, and wanting that, but then finding it difficult to practice, either because of fear or this second reason that I'm explaining, the desire to live and enjoy the benefits of living in a Western society without being kind of separated, where we're not able to enjoy everything. And we see people around us enjoying certain things, and we'd like to be part of that as well. But we're told we can't. So that desire causes the question in one's mind, for some people, about the legitimacy of these practical laws, at the very least, as I said, in modern times, in a modern society. And for others, and I hope we are of the third group of people, sometimes seeing differences and seeing a different approach towards life causes one to wonder, why is our way of life something that is better? I mean, what makes that the right solution for the way we should live our lives? Especially, I find this a little more in those who've experienced the life in the Muslim countries. And then we travel over here and we see, you know, wow, it's really nice. You know, it's very modern. You see that apparently, especially here in Canada, if you've been in the U.S., I mean, there's a lot of difficulties to deal with. Healthcare and insurance and medical care in general are very expensive, and at times it can be very difficult to get. But here, you get a lot of government support, for those at least who are citizens. I don't know how the laws work here for others. But anyhow, they seem to be, you go to the stores, like in some of the countries that I have visited in the Middle East, you go over there to the store, the guy doesn't even want to say salams to you. You know, they don't really like talking to you. You ask him a couple of questions, like, look, you want to take it, you don't want to, just get out of here. Okay. Get in the cab, you don't necessarily hear a pleasant, you know, greetings from the person. And you may have to, even from an Islamic perspective, if I want to be a practicing person, going in the streets of Tehran and trying to get in a cab without them putting haram music on, and if you want to, if you dare open your mouth and say something about that, you're going to be let off right in the middle of the highway at times. Okay. So, you're out here, like, people actually respect you. You know, people deal with you as a human being. Alright. Even the police, well, if we haven't had serious encounters with the wrong police maybe out here, because if you have that, then you'll change your mind. But, you know, first you come here, it sounds and it feels different, you know. It feels like they got the best of both worlds, or you can get the best of both worlds right here. Okay. I mean, we're sitting in this classroom, they're talking about, yeah, the freedom of religion, and this is pretty free. Okay, I'm sitting here with the clothes that I'm wearing, and we're talking about a religion that is not really, well, to an extent, maybe it's accepted as an existing religion out here, but to adhere to the values of Islam and to accept them, that's something that you're not going to find out here. Okay, but they're tolerant of it. We can discuss here matters that are not acceptable by Western society. Alright, so we look at this, like, okay, so what's wrong? Why is it that if people want to wear, not want to wear hijab, for example, in the Islamic Republic, then that is stopped and that is banned. And even if you don't believe in it, you're going to have to wear it. Okay? Why is it that certain practical laws are in place? Out here, it's very different. For example, And there's a long list of examples that I can go over just for an hour talking about different examples, but I'll just suffice with a few. Right? The treatment that Islam gives to people who decide that they look at the logic and the reason of Islam, for example, and they decide that they don't want that religion anymore. Okay, an apostate. All right, that's one of those difficult questions if asked. What do you believe about the status of Islam with an apostate? You know, the Islamic law is pretty clear-cut. You know, it's not very difficult. If the person is an apostate, if they were originally Muslim by birth, then the penal law is that we're going to have to take their life. Okay, that's it. If they announce that, that's pretty simple. It's not something that we can actually wonder about in the text, because we do have areas where we can kind of question and go through the text and say, all right, there's different understandings of it. But when it comes to some of the other forms of, or other parts of the penal law of Islam, where you have some very severe punishments, okay, the way Islam looks at homosexuality and homosexuals, all right, out here, you're pretty free. It's part of the liberal democracy, okay? It's part of the liberalism out here that people should be free. Part of that is what causes some of us to enjoy liberties and freedoms here that we don't enjoy in some other countries, even Muslim countries. For example, if you would want to do this dua tawassul in public in Saudi Arabia, you probably would not be able to do that. It's a Muslim country, but they don't believe in the legitimacy of tawassul, and they think that is kufr. So if you do that in Mecca and Medina, you may at times face difficulties, and you may want to do that in hiding or in private. So part of this is something that we enjoy. These liberties are something that we enjoy. So why not? Why don't we have this freedom? Okay, why isn't this a better way to deal with it? Why shouldn't people have the right to choose their own sexuality? Okay, what's the problem with that? So these questions come to mind. Or in regards to women's rights, I mean, that becomes a very serious issue out here. Okay, because we have a long list of questions to answer to people about the legitimacy of our religion. It's easy to reason about the existence of God. It's easy to reason about the hereafter. It's easy to reason about prophethood. It's easy to reason about imamate even. These are not very difficult issues to reason with. We have very sound, legitimate, and rational arguments for them. But when it comes to the practices, it becomes a little more difficult. Okay? The treatment of Islam, for example, of women, is something that in, when Islam arrived in Arabia, in that particular part of the world, or in fact in all of the world, women were mistreated, treated as commodities, they were inherited. All right, Islam came and said, no, women are not inherited. And women actually receive inheritance. In a society where there was no inheritance that women received, then okay, Islam introduced the idea of women receiving inheritance instead of being inherited. Okay, that's great. It was progressive at that time. But in this day and age, in the modern times, where we have, equality, and there's movements against discrimination based on gender, then this is not something that is very progressive. It's actually backwards. We are digressing, because we're moving back to those times. In this day and age, we're talking about equality, so everything's got to be split in half. Why does a woman get half the share of, or a sister get half the share of a brother if their father passes away? Why does that work in that way? Why is it that the right to divorce is something that is given to men? It's not given to women. There are some exceptions where a judge would be able to divorce a woman where she's being abused. So there is a way out of that. But if a woman just decides, I just don't like to live with this guy anymore, she doesn't have the right to do that. But if a guy decides that, I don't like to live with her anymore, then he does get the right to divorce. Okay. So why is that? So when we look at these examples, and then we compare them to the practices out here, to the legal system, to the way that the West is looking at women, looking at other areas of life and how to deal with it and how to manage it. For some people, it's just a question of, okay, we see something different. Before we saw it, okay, this sounds great. But then when the question is posed, then we're looking for answers. Okay, does Islam actually have something? And then the approach that we take as Muslims, as those who believe in Islam, in regards to these questions, is very different, depending on, as I said, what the reasoning for why we're asking these questions is. Recite the salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
I want to emphasize that it's important that we look at these questions and we try to find answers for them as Muslims. And we shouldn't be afraid. We should not be afraid at all. One problem that some of the believers face in dealing with these issues and these questions is that they're afraid of their faith. They don't want to deal with the question. If the questions are raised, they just say, you know, the answer is Islam is against this, we believe in God, and that's it. Okay. And whenever, especially in the Muslim world, these questions are raised, people ask these questions, then there's this fear of what are we going to do with this? But we shouldn't be afraid. As Shaykh Mutahhari used to say, says whenever some such questions are raised by those who are against Islam, the enemies of Islam, some people start getting scared and feeling fear of what are we going to do with this. And he says, I actually feel very happy because we get an opportunity, Muslim scholars get an opportunity. That's an area that maybe we hadn't thought of as much. And we go and dig deeper. If we're living in the East, there are certain things that are given to us as religion. There are certain things that we practice in religious families and we are raised with, and we hold the value and we hold them dear to ourselves. These are Islamic values. And that does not allow us to think that maybe actually Islam does not hold value in these things that we respect. It's actually something that's related to the culture that I lived in. Or it's the view of one of the scholars. Maybe there's other views that are there as well. Okay, and maybe some of the other views are even better, and they are the correct view of Islam. So many times we see when dealing with issues that in some of the Eastern cultures they are valued much, we find that it's difficult for people to get past the biases of being raised with a particular culture, considering that culture to be religion. Okay, this is one area that we got to be very careful with. But another area, and I remember, let me just give you one example. When Shaykh Mutahhari wrote his book on hijab, and one of the things that he said there is that this black chador that we have in Iran and some of the other countries, Muslim countries, is not something that comes from Islam. Okay, it's something that Islam has a certain set of certain criteria for the dress code that women need to have. You can wear it based on that the framework of Islam. You can wear any type of clothing that has and meets those standards. It doesn't have to be a black all over cover that we refer to as the chador or the abaya amongst the Arabs. It doesn't have to be that. If it meets the standards, then it meets the standards. Some of the scholars, some of people that he knew and they knew him very well, when they received the book, they started writing commentaries on the side, and he received it and he was very disappointed because of the biases that some of these scholars had in regards to the issue of hijab and the way they thought that this is religion. Okay. And he had issue with that. He had an issue, and some scholars disliked his views because of the biases that they had, the culture that they were raised in, and considering that to be religion. This is one bias that we need to avoid. But there's another bias that out here in the West we can easily fall under the influence of, and not just in the West, also in the East, which is on a daily basis being influenced And every day we're being influenced more than before from and by the Western culture and Western values. So the biases of the Western culture that we live in, especially since it is natural for one who sees both and looks at the advancements and the developments in the Western world, it's very easy to look at that and to feel inferior to that and to want to become like that and to think that the ideologies, the way of life in the West is better than that of the East and it's better than that of what the Muslims practice. And sometimes that causes, although we're trying to be religious, although we're trying to follow Islam, it causes us to believe that Islam's way is that which is out here. And they are better Muslims in practice to a certain degree, some of their practices at least. Okay, so we come to accept and we come to believe that some of the ways of life out here are better than what the Muslims practice. Not saying that it's better than Islam, but because of the way we feel towards them and we like Islam, we kind of say, okay, this is Islam. Islam actually encourages this. All right. We got to be very careful of that because, again, we can very easily fall into that as well. So we've got to try to avoid that. Without any of those, try to look at Islam and try to find answers. The easiest way to try to deal with some of these issues, for those who are very lazy and they're trying to just satisfy their desire to be religious, but at the same time fit into the Western lifestyle, fit into Western society, the easiest way is to, in a very radical way, rethink Islam. Look at the verses and the ahadith and question everything. Yeah, well, you know, stoning isn't really mentioned in the Holy Quran. Some hadith, and who knows what hadith is valid and is not. We just don't want to, you know, address the issues that are related to us through hadith because there's a lot of contradictions. We just don't want to go that way, that route. Or another thing that we hear at times is that, you know what? Quran as the book of guidance speaking to us 1400 years ago is a book that God was speaking in a particular language for a particular people in a particular culture, but we need to understand the essence of the law and what He's trying to say there. Not take it literally and at face value. Okay, that sounds very nice. Okay, very intellectual for now. Okay, then what do you mean by that? For example, when it says "As-sariq was-sariqah faqta'u aydiyahuma," if you have thieves, male or female, then cut their fingers. It says cut their hands, but then hadith explains that it's the four fingers. Okay. When it says it in that very clear language, they say, well, you know, you need to take the essence of that. What is the essence of it? Inflicting some form of pain. Back in those days, killing was very easy. All right. Very barbaric society. So taking one's life is very easy. So cutting off a few fingers is pretty easy as well. All right. So these people who go through a lot of pain in life, the only way to inflict serious pain that would cause them to stop stealing is to actually cut their fingers off. But if we bring that to modern times, we can't actually do that. The essence of the law is to inflict some form of pain. So we do that in this day and age, in this material capitalist society, by what? The same way that the government deals with people. You write them a big ticket, okay, they would have to pay, you fine them, they have to pay for it. On top of returning what they've taken, they also have to pay a fine for it. All right. That's inflicting some form of economic pain, or maybe psychological, depending how you want to look at it. So take the essence of the law. These are easy ways to look at it and just question everything and just give ourselves comfort that we are Muslims, we are believers, we are practicing. But at the same time, when they ask us about these laws, we have some very intellectual answers for them. No, Islam actually doesn't say that. And we ask, well, what does Islam say about homosexuals? We've read in some of your fiqh books that they have some very severe punishments, such as burning, if someone gets involved with the act, sodomy, then that means that they're going to be burnt to death, or their heads chopped off. That's very brutal, you know. It does not sound very pleasant. When they ask you that, that is very severe. You know, they say there's five punishments, at least in some fiqh books. I don't know if there's any of the current fuqaha that I would respect as faqih that would question that, but one of them is burning to death. One of them is chopping off their head. Third is to throw them off a cliff. Fourth is to tear down a wall on them. And fifth is a combination of the above. Okay. Now, that's pretty severe, you know. That's very severe. Or the punishment of stoning. I mean, have you ever thought of having a human being in front of you and the person being stoned? That's pretty brutal. Okay. It's very severe. So I can feel comfortable. I believe in Islam. And I say, actually, I think I'm protecting Islam. I say, you know what? No. That's not the case. That's in some unreliable hadith. No, it's not in the Holy Quran. Right? That's an easy way out. If we're actually trying to do what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, if we're actually believing in God, then that's not the approach that we can take. There's many different areas to discuss in regards to the practices that we have, the laws that we have in Islam, which there's plenty of that does not actually fit within the Western liberal values and the human rights that have been adopted by the West and by the United Nations. Some of them don't, we cannot accept that. There's plenty of them. Okay. There are many things to say. One thing, let me clarify. Sometimes people introduce this idea, and it is correct to an extent, but we have to understand what exactly it means. This idea that Islam has got components within the practices, elements within the practices that are thabit, they remain the same, they are not changeable, and they are there until the end of time. And then you have certain practices that are actually mutaghayyirat, they change. Okay, we can have a law for a time, but then that changes to something different. Or we have something like that. So people who learn some of these things, then they kind of try to go and play around with that. One thing that I need to make clear here, yeah, we do have certain things that are thawabit and certain things that are mutaghayyirat, certain things that remain the same and certain things that go all the way until the end of time. But we can't pick and choose which one's going to be which. We have got to see what Islam has if we accept it as an ideology. If we either accept it as a package or we reject it. Accepting parts of it and rejecting parts of it is not really rejecting it. Accepting it. We cannot accept Islam in that way. You either accept it as a full package or you reject it as a full package. Rejecting part of it is rejecting the full thing according to the Quran itself. Okay. So we can't make that decision. What Islam has done in regards to those mutaghayyirat, those things that change, Islam has very wisely not even given us legislation in regards to them. Right? Islam has not even given us specific legislation related to those areas of life that require constant changing laws. Instead of that, Islam has established an institution within the legal system that takes care of the needs of each time and says that for this time, you're going to have this law, and then for a different time, you're going to have a different law. Instead of it being a particular law, it is going to be in an institution. What is that institution? The institution is the institution of leadership. A particular person, which during the time of the presence of the Ma'sum, the infallibles, is the Ma'sum himself. And during the time of the occultation, according to what we have from the infallibles themselves, is that that responsibility has got to be taken on by the just, pious jurists. Anyone that meets the standard can be able to do that. If they see a need, they legislate temporary laws. And when the time changes, then they legislate a different law, and that goes away. All right. So Islam hasn't even legislated laws that pertain to particular circumstances only, which would not carry on centuries later. The legislations that are part of the Sharia of Islam are the thawabit, are what remains until the end of time. And that's why we have hadith from the Holy Prophet, Al-Halal Muhammadin Halalun ila yawm al-qiyamah, wa haramun haramun ila yawm al-qiyamah. Recite the salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad. So, that's one thing that I wanted to clarify. But in approaching the different laws that we have, and to try to actually look and see, are any of the mentioned laws or other laws that are controversial, are they laws that apply to a certain context? Or are they something that apply to this day and age as well? And looking at some of the advancements and some of the changes that have occurred in society, people find it very difficult for them to apply in this day and age. And they say, it's not really compatible. It's just not compatible. You can't take those laws and apply them to a life out here in the West. It's just not doable. Okay. So there's many different ways to approach this, many of which would go through each and every one of those individual laws and tell us whether, for what reason, we're going to come to the conclusion that this law is universal in all times and all locations, all the way until the end of time, and which one is actually something that was temporary during the time of the Ma'sumin. It applied for a particular time, and then afterwards it doesn't apply to people. But I'm not going to take that route, because that would require a lot of time. What I'd like to say in regards to these laws is something from a different approach, meaning instead of looking at the evidence that gives us those laws and trying to figure out literally, is there any indication within that that causes it to be temporary or for it to apply to all times and all places, instead of that, I'd like to look at it from a very different approach, a more holistic approach. Looking at the entire system, when we're looking at a particular legal system and we're trying to see if these laws apply to a particular place and time, based on a certain culture that exists, a certain lifestyle that exists in a particular part of the world, and to say that it does or does not apply, or to say that actually, in modern times where people have advanced, and we look at some of the advancements in the West, and we look at their lifestyle and what has led to their advancement, and we see that, okay, you know, this way of life is something that's actually better. It's better to have women contribute to society the same way that men do, as opposed to what Islam propagates. It's better to not limit the interactions of the two genders the way Islam does. No, people should be a lot freer. Okay, they should be able to communicate, interact in a lot more free and casual way. That's better, because it leads to what we can see out here. It's not a good idea to say that no, we're supposed to be segregated. When we look at these two different systems, and we're looking at the outcome and the result here, and sometimes we go with that result and say, you know, this is the better way to do it. And to satisfy ourselves again, we look at the Islamic system and we say that that was good for that day and age. Or if it's not for satisfying ourselves, if we're trying to find answers to give to those who don't even believe in Islam, we find it difficult. What do we say to a person that questions Islam on its treatment of homosexuals, its treatment of women? What do we say to such a person? What's our response going to be? When they ask us, okay, if you're a Muslim, then what do you say about an apostate? What are we going to turn around and say? Even if we don't believe in something, but just to satisfy them, we're going to say, well, there's questions or doubts, or how are we going to approach that? I think the most important thing to to look at and to consider is, instead of looking at the laws and trying to decide which law is better, which is how the West approaches it, how many Muslims in the West approach it, the freedoms that we see, for example, in the West, and the limitations that we see in Muslim countries, they compare, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran or Saudi Arabia. For the Sunnis, they usually refer to Saudi Arabia. For Shias or for others, maybe they refer to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Okay, there are certain limitations. You are limited. You are restricted. And here you have a lot of those freedoms. So you're looking at that, and you're comparing these two laws. And it should be this way or the other way. Recite the salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Islam's treatment of women, inheritance, the way it's divided up, the way families are divided up in this day and age, the way divorce works, in Muslim countries, more and more we see that the issue of divorce is becoming a serious issue. There are a lot of women that feel that they are undergoing a lot of abuse. They don't want to be in that situation. They want to leave, and they don't have the right to divorce. The situation of taking care of the children after the divorce. If we look at the Islamic system, well, it says that, well, the maximum is up to the age 7, according to some, that the mother would be able to take care of the child. And afterwards, it's going to go to the father. The child's going to go to the father. And according to many, it's 2 years of age. Okay. So, how does that work in this day and age? And plenty, plenty more issues that people start to wonder how that needs to work. And we need to try to think about a way to change that. All right. I hope I've given the impression that I'm trying to in regards to the laws and the difficulties of applying them in this day and age. One way to look at this, which is a wrong approach that usually we have, is to look at the effects of these actions and the way we deal with life in the temporary and the short-term results that we can see in them. And judge based on that and say, okay, we should actually adopt this way of life or the other way of life. But one thing that we neglect and Islam emphasizes on is that the laws of Islam are based on a foundation. It is wrong to look at, and a lot of times we do, it's wrong to look at the practices of Islam without looking at the beliefs of Islam and how they are related, the practices are related to the aqaid and the belief system. That's a very wrong approach. A lot of times we do this. And we don't see the connection. We think, oh, it's very fine to believe in God, in the Day of Judgment, in prophethood, and practice in this way. What's the problem? Alright? But it becomes very problematic. Okay, the belief in God, and belief in God in a way that He is present in everything that happens in our life, and not having that faith make it completely different. If God is the one, some very simple examples. If God is the one that provides sustenance, I'll start with some more, you know, known as maybe more religious or faith-based examples, then I'll move along to some of the others. If we believe truly, if it is fact, not just belief, because usually when we talk about belief, sometimes the word carries a certain connotation to it, such that you believe in something and it doesn't really have much reality to it. I want to emphasize that if it is reality, if the reality of the situation is that God is the one that makes everything happen, every second of this life, every moment of this life, it's going to be very different than if we don't have that. Part of what He does is provide sustenance. He is Ar-Razzaq. Okay? If that's fact, if that's reality, then worrying about the workplace and how they're going to be accepting me and them not accepting me doesn't become a worry. If God is the one that's going to be providing, truly, and this is only one avenue that that sustenance can come to me, then really the way they're going to think of me is besides the point. It's not really important, because it's God that's going to be providing for me. And He has said in the Holy Quran that وَمَن يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا وَيَرْزُقْهُ مِنْ حَيْثُ لَا يَحْتَسِبْ. If you do what I tell you, if you're supposed to cover yourself, if you're not supposed to wear makeup, if you are supposed to behave in a certain way, if you need to take time off for your prayer and not allow your prayer to become qada, if you need to do all of those things that I have told you, then go ahead and do them. They're gonna kick me out, they're gonna fire me. I'm the one that's gonna provide for you, and I will provide through means that you least expected. Okay, if that's fact, then the way I'm going to behave in order to gain sustenance is very different. The prescriptions that we will receive to live or to behave such that we're going to have more money and a better life, it's going to be very different. In light of this reality, then performing the night prayers bringing us more sustenance makes sense. Okay? When the hadith says, there's plenty of them, that if you wake up for the night prayer, it doesn't only have effects on you for the hereafter, it has effects on you right here in this world. What does it do? It increases sustenance. Right? When it said that when you visit your relatives, then that is going to cause the increase of your sustenance. In this ideology, it makes sense and it's going to happen. You don't increase your work time such that you don't have time to visit even your own family. Every time you go home, the kids are asleep. That lifestyle is not going to make sense based on this ideology. You've got to make time for your family, because that is what's going to increase your sustenance. Alright? But if you remove that, all of that is just something that has to... It's superficial and superstitious. It's not really frank. That's not how you should behave. You should go to bed early, wake up early in the morning, do whatever it takes, be very strict, get the kids to sleep, even if it means you're going to mistreat them, just to make sure you get to sleep on time and you wake up on time, mistreat and misbehave towards all of them, don't see your family members, work two shifts so you get some money, so you get your sustenance. These are two different ways that this can work. The verse of the Holy Quran says, and these are very serious when we're talking about the Islamic economic system, we have got to realize that there's fundamental differences between the systems. You can't just introduce and take whatever the Western system is and bring it and just add that to the Islamic society and to the Islamic practice and say, okay, this is how you do it. No, it's not. You can't work like that. Because Islam has its foundations, and based on those foundations it gives prescriptions, and based on that says certain things should not be practiced. And they have a negative consequence right here in this world. We've got to work on the foundations and see how they are related to these. For instance, I'll give you another example that's less ritualistic. One of the areas that we're facing serious questions on, and I hope we have as brothers and sisters here serious questions on, is the way of life and how it's different when you look at men and women in Islam. To make us understand what I'm speaking of, let me give you a couple of examples. Islam does not restrict women from education. All right, Islam actually supports that idea. Women get educated. Islam does not say women should not work. Okay, or it's wrong for them to work outside and to earn money. That's not something that Islam does not say women should not do that. Alright? Islam does not say that they should not hold public office. They should not be active members of society in the sense that, you know, they actually contribute the way a man does. Islam doesn't say that's prohibited, that's banned, that's wrong, it is haram. However, if we put in to the picture all of the elements of the practices of Islam, we will find that sometimes, or a lot of times, it becomes very difficult to be and live like that. For instance, one major obstacle is that women get married. Once they're married, a clear-cut fatwa, the ruling that we have clear hadith on it, is for her to leave the house. She needs her husband's permission. Now, practically, that means limitation. Okay? What if, for whatever reason, the husband says, I don't want you to do that? Okay? I don't want you. He woke up this morning, he just didn't like that to happen. And we spoke to him, we had others speak to him, everything, and he's just not, no, I don't want that to happen. Well, Islamically, then she can't leave the house. That means limitation. Okay? So when we look at this, or another area that we find important, I need to give this as an example as well, Islam's approach towards family, towards having children, towards taking care of those children, practically, what happens is that women are going to end up dealing with children more and dealing with work in the house more than working outside. And that's something that in the West, it's not really acceptable. Okay, it's not something that people move towards. And people have serious questions on. A lot of sisters have serious questions on. Now, if we look at the Western examples and the Western examples of success, what the West considers a successful woman is someone who has had accomplishments in having a university degree, in having a good paying job, in actually having a significant impact on society. If you have the first president or prime minister in the Western countries, whichever country had the first one, okay, that's a great accomplishment for that woman. All right, or getting a degree, that's a great accomplishment. And if a person does not have such an accomplishment, I'm finishing. If a person does not have that, they don't have such an accomplishment. So when we're looking at the Islamic system, we're looking at women are actually being deprived of that. Right? That's something that a lot of people say. Women are being deprived of a successful life. Now the approach that some of us have is that, no, Islam doesn't do that. Islam encourages this, this, that, the other. And, well, I would like to agree with that, and to a very good extent I do, but the method of that I disagree with, because that leads many to think that, all right, accomplishment in life is that. And women who are in the house working, then that's not a great accomplishment. And what causes them to have to be in that situation is not good. Therefore, these laws that are keeping women from becoming that active member of society is something that we should try to move away from. Okay? But I'd like to say this, and we'll try to end with this. If you're looking at accomplishments from a purely worldly perspective, looking at money, looking at prestige in this world, yeah, you're absolutely right. Prestige is given to a woman that has education, that has a job, that makes money, that becomes politically active, that holds some form of office. That is accomplishment. If we don't have that, then we don't have that accomplishment. If I don't have a good paying job, then I'm a loser. Okay. If I don't have university education, then I'm a loser. All right. But if that's not the way, if the reality is that this world is a temporal world, prestige, money, all of that, goes away after 50 years, after 60 years, 70 years, 100 years. It's all gone. If we realize that this life is not the end of it, if the fact and the reality is that this life is not the end of it, there's another life after this. The definition of success and prosperity changes completely. Okay? The definition of prosperity and success, if there is an afterlife, is going to be something related to that life, because that is eternal. And this life is temporal. Whatever is going to remain in this world is not acceptable. It's not going to be real success. It will not be our definition of prosperity, because that's temporary. If you see a child having a lot of fun with a video game and thinking that that is great, what do you tell them? Like, look, this is temporary fun. This is not something that you would want to waste your time on. This is not prosperity. As a child, that's how they define, that's how they understand it. But as someone that's grown beyond that, you're like, no, you shouldn't waste your time on that. You want to get your education. Why? Because in the long run, that's how you're going to be able to enjoy yourself. So even that, if that long run is only 40 years, 50 years, 100 years, then there's something that's eternal after that. Whatever is going to remain in this temporary life is going to become secondary. It's not really the primary goal. And if we look at that and try to define prosperity and see that the prosperity lies in the worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and how we can get closer to Him, that being the objective of life, then that whole thing changes. The whole thing changes. In this system, in this value system, with these realities, understanding these realities, it is that being a mother is more important than the education. Isn't bad. Education is encouraged, as I say. But if there's a conflict between the two, it's either or. A lot of times it's not either or. Okay, you can do both. But it's in a particular situation, it's either or. Who do you give? What do you give preference to? What takes priority? Well, if in the system that considers my prestige, my earning to be my success, then forget the kids. Leave them with a babysitter or something. Just make sure the education is taken care of. But don't spend time on them. Go to your job. Go to, get your education and so on and so forth. But if it's the worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then that's a different approach towards life. Okay, the laws are going to be different. If it's worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then the relationship between husband and wife, how they're going to treat one another is going to change. It's not about me, I want to make sure I get this, and he wants to make sure he gets this, or she wants to make sure she gets a certain thing in this world, in this dunya. Everything changes based on our understanding of the real world and the connection between them. And everything is connected to those fundamentals, to those foundations. Islam, in order to have a healthy society where people are all moving towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the goal of their creation, then it requires a healthy family. A healthy family requires that family to stick together. Therefore, divorce is going to be limited to one party, and that's going to be the man. It's based on that ideology that this is going to make sense. It's based on that ideology that in that relationship, it is best for the women, for the woman, for the wife, to remain in the house for the prosperity of that family, and to not leave without her husband being okay with it. All right? It's all connected to the ideology. If we see that connection, then that's where we're going to find that reason. And if we don't believe in that, it's not going to make sense. If someone does not believe that there is a hereafter, God is in control of things, then explaining why we dislike homosexuals, or homosexuality in the act actually, not homosexuals meaning people who have inclinations towards the same gender, then that's not going to make sense at all. Or why? They want to choose to do that. Why do you want to stop them? They have the freedom of that choice. Like, yeah, you're right. If there is no hereafter, you're absolutely right. But a lot of other things don't make sense either. If there's no hereafter, I don't see why one should not have the liberty of mistreating others. Okay, if they can get away with it. And actually, that's something that does make sense out here, and people do it. So basically, the point that I'm trying to drive home here is that all of the practices in Islam are based on the ideology. That's why we have hadith that says, if you want to summarize all of Islam, it's summarized in Tawheed. Because everything is connected to the concept of Tawheed, the oneness of God. Whether it's belief in the hereafter, prophethood, imamat, adl, whatever it is, it's related to that. And then all of the practices are based on that foundation. That's how that makes sense. You remove that, it doesn't make sense. If you want to debate with someone that doesn't believe the foundation, there's no way you can prove your point. It's only based on the acceptance of these ideological values and seeing them as realities that this set of practices is going to make sense. Without that, it will not make sense. And with this set of practices, it's only this which makes sense. You cannot change it. One little change is going to have a very significant and very disastrous effect. And we cannot notice that effect. It's not something that would say, oh, what's the problem? Let's change this for a while. Let's try it out. Well, we can't do that. It has a very disastrous effect. And we can only rely on revelation for that based on this ideology. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us deeper understanding in religion. I'm sorry that I took too long. Say salawat, please. Okay. We were supposed to have questions. I don't know how much time we have, but yeah.
You mentioned that some people. Then what would be the consequence of that during this time? You rejected that idea, but you didn't give reasons for that. Mm-hmm. Why can't we practice? Why can't we follow that? Because it makes sense, to some extent.
To an extent, it may make sense. The explanation of it, briefly, if I may go over that. As I said, if we base things on the ideology, okay, that based on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala being the supreme being, and He is the only God, and that there is a hereafter, and our conduct, understanding the human being, everything we do has an effect on our souls. And that's not something that we can necessarily identify and notice ourselves. We rely on revelation. Okay? This is a very fundamental conclusion that we would be reaching. If we accept another ideology, we're not going to be relying on revelation for law. If we accept the ideology that we have, the beliefs that we have, then we rely heavily on revelation. I cannot decide if this is going to have a positive effect or the other is going to have a positive effect. I'm going to rely on what? I'm going to rely on revelation. So if I'm supposed to be relying on revelation, we've got to look at the ways that we will be interpreting text. Okay? Hermeneutics. How we are supposed to be understanding text. Because God has spoken to us in a language, we've got to look at that language and we have to understand it. Now, if God has told us very specifically, as-sariqu was-sariqa faqta'u aydiyahuma, the one who steals, male or female, cut their hands. That's very clear what it's trying to say. If you want to come out and say that, no, there's a hidden meaning to that, all right, then that hidden meaning is either coming from revelation, which we don't have any prophets that are coming, or it's based on a prophetic saying or a hadith from the imams. We cannot have that just decided. I just pick and choose and say, well, where it says that, حَيْثُمَا كُنْتُمْ فَوَلُّوا وُجُوهَكُمْ شَطْرَهُ, wherever you're at, face the qibla, face the Kaaba. I want to decide, well, you know what? That's not actually literally meant. What is it meant? Men, face the Qibla, which is the house of God, everything is the house of God based on some of the other verses of the Holy Quran. So this is not literally meant. Okay. Then basically, the laws, the rules of understanding text do not allow us to understand in that way. How can we understand from As-Sariq wa As-Sariqa faqta'u aydiyahuma? If God wanted to tell us inflict pain, He could have told us inflict pain. And then He would have given us that as an example, just like we do in other cases we have. For example, in many of the other parts of the penal law of Islam, there's not a particular punishment that is given. It's the ta'zir, they call it, has been given to the judge, the responsibility of giving ta'zir to that person. That is inflicting pain. What type of pain? Now, there's a difference of opinion. Is that only going to be physical pain, lashes, which we have a lot of hadith on? Or according to some of the others there, the essence is, or the law, the wording of it is such, that the idea is to inflict some form of pain. But when it's literally saying that فَقْتَوْ أَيْدِيَهُمَا, if you want to come out and say that that line there doesn't mean it, you would have to have an explanation. It's either through revelation or some other text. If we don't have that other text, then it's not from revelation, it's from me. Okay? It's my innovation, it's my addition, it's my contribution. I think that this, otherwise the words of that is going to be very clear. So, if I want to word it slightly differently, if we rely on revelation, and the revelation is in the form of a language, we've got to understand that language the way everybody understands that language. And we cannot decide that we want to understand that in a way where no one speaking that language is going to understand it. That is going to be clear. Yes? What is that?
Is this the only answer to all of these questions that for some discussion in the seminar, or there are other approaches to this question?
Different approaches. What I tried to give here was, as I said, a holistic answer. A holistic answer doesn't deal with details. Okay? So, and this is one approach. Okay? If you're trying to explain the logic of a law, alright, what I'm trying to say, and I'm trying to explain, is that understanding the logic of the law will be based on the foundations of faith. That's the only way you can explain it logically. Okay? Because sometimes our questions are about reason. Why this? Why this law? Why the other law? Okay? For that type of questioning, then this would be the real answer that should be given. I hear other answers that are given. For example, people trying to say, I don't know, for even prayer. I've heard some funny, to me they're funny, explanations of why we pray this certain way. They try to, I don't know how accurate their quotations are even. That they say, oh, this position of sujood has this effect on your brain or something like that. And they try to explain it in that way. That's really not the reason why you're supposed to be praying this particular way. Or that if you pray towards the direction of the Qibla, there's something physical about that that has an effect on, I don't know, the molecules in your body. That's not the reason why we're supposed to be praying in that direction. Because first, the direction was somewhere else, and then we changed in this direction. Okay? So, some other explanations are given, and I've heard of them. But if we're trying to answer this question, or any question that's related to why we have certain practices, we have got to always take them and bring them down to the ideology that we have. With that, it makes sense. In some cases, there may be some logical explanation we can give that may make sense. For example, for some people, it may be acceptable if we explain to people that, all right, God has created women with, or women are the manifestation of His beauty, and that beauty has got to be concealed except in front of the maharam. Otherwise, it's going to, because of the attraction that men have to female beauty, then that's going to cause corruption. That corruption is going to cause harm to the woman herself and to everybody else in society. And therefore, that's why Islam says that women need to cover. For some people, that's convincing. But I can personally think of comments to make to destroy that argument. Now, why do we need to have that in the first place? And maybe if we have strong law enforcement, we can avoid that. And plenty of other things that may be said in theory, that we can try to avoid those other things. Okay. The only real answer to any of that is one that connects this to the ideology. Based on the existence of God and the hereafter and all of that, this makes sense. Otherwise, I can find reasons why I wouldn't accept this type of practice. Okay, why we would, for example, one of the things I find interesting, there's a documentary made in the West. It's called Demographic Winter. You can download it on, it's found online. You can order it or download it from one of those sites that has those movies, films. Demographic Winter. The Demographic Winter. It's very interesting how they analyze, as Western academics that are mainly atheists, what the effect of what they refer to as the sexual revolution and homosexuality has had on the demographics of the West. They're talking about a population decline that is happening in the Western world as a whole, in Western Europe, in the United States of America, probably in Canada as well. All right? And that is the decline in the population. The rate of the increase in population, if it goes below a certain rate, you cannot revive a culture, a people. Okay, it's moving towards destruction and decline. Okay, in the West, it's moved below that, except for families that are faithful, whether they are Muslim, Christian, Jewish, or whatever they may be. Okay, and they analyze how the sexual revolution that has caused families, first of all, not to even form, and then when you have families, people not wanting children, okay, which is something that Islam actually encourages us to have children, that is causing this problem. All right, you know, that what I saw, that I was like, you know, we need to have an Islamic class just to explain for people who have the question, for Muslims who have this question, why these laws are there, why homosexuality is bad. Here you go. This is part of the reason. But even if we accept that, people may say, what the heck, I don't care if my population is... I don't care. I want to have a good life. All right? I want to enjoy myself. I don't care what the next generation has. So what? Yeah, that's an answer. If you don't care, then you don't care. Okay? The only way you can convince that person is if they are able to be convinced about the ideal. You want to have a good life? Okay, you can have an eternal life that you enjoy all of these things plus more in a much better way. And if you don't do this, you're going to be in hellfire. Now, if that's understood, then you can explain how this makes a whole lot more sense. Okay, so that's one that I'm trying to get to. There's another approach, another form of questioning that happens, that the reasoning or the type of answer, the holistic answer that I gave, is not really related to that. And that is where we question, is something Islamic or not? Okay. Sometimes the question is, okay, is hijab actually something that's Islamic? Is the headscarf something that is Islamic? It's, some say it's not found in the Holy Quran, which is apparently not correct. Okay. Is stoning legitimate? Is it Islamic or not? Well, that's a different type of approach that needs to be taken. After having clarified this idea that we rely on revelation, we can't decide for ourselves based on the reasonings given, then we look at the scripture, we have a methodology of understanding if something is actually from Islam or it's not from Islam. There are certain, and I tried to very briefly give response to the previous question, there are very rigorous studies in regards to how to interpret and understand text. It's a whole science of its own. It's a discipline of its own. In the West, they call it hermeneutics, but it's not in the Muslim scholarship. It's not only hermeneutics. It's a series of discussions and debates that are referred to as usul al-fiqh, part of which is kind of similar to hermeneutics. And that's what I was trying to give to the brother. How we are supposed to understand text. How much freedom do we have in understanding it? What part does the understanding of the individual play in understanding the text? The environment. How much do we have to rely on trying to understand the intentions of the author? And discussions of that sort. Or other questions in regards to authenticity of hadith. What type of hadith are we able to accept? Which ones are we not able to accept? that question of whether something is Islamic or not is a completely different question and a different set of questions in regards to the different details. And the way we address that is completely different. We would have to go over the principles of jurisprudence and then go through the verses in the hadith related to that and then come to a conclusion whether this is Islamic or it's not Islamic, or whether we can actually debate whether it's Islamic or not, or we cannot even debate that. It's clear-cut Islam and there's no way we can question that.
Thank you very much. We don't have enough time for the questions. If you have another session tomorrow, that's...